This is the story of a man who achieved world fame and recognition, and to whom it was a constant source of surprise. This is the story of a man who loved all the things God created, who loved all the outdoors had to offer with a passion for fishing, putting, and golf. He excelled at many things besides singing. His photography won many prizes. Numerous homes in his hometown can boast of end tables, coffee tables, and whatnot, beautifully done by his hands. But his first love was fishing. In Earlham Cemetery in Richmond, Indiana, he now rests. But his glorious voice is still heard all over the country through his transcriptions. On his monument, his wife had this little poem carved, which expresses more beautifully than I can the simplicity of desires and thoughts of a man known to the whole world as your old friend, Singin' Sam. Don't want medals on my breast. Don't want all the glory. I'm not worrying greatly lest the world won't hear my story. A chance to dream beside a stream where fish are biting free. A day or two neath skies of blue is joy enough for me. I do not ask a hoard of gold nor treasures rich and rare. I don't want all the joys to hold. I only want my share. Just now and then, away from men, all their haunts of pride, if I can steal with rod and reel, I'll be satisfied. I'll gladly work my way through life. I would not always play. I only ask to quit the strife for an occasional day. If I can sneak from toil a week to chum with stream and tree, I'll fish away and smiling say that life's been good to me. Born in Hillsboro, Ohio, January the 27th, 1888. His earliest memories were of Danville, Kentucky, where his family moved when he was 3 years old. The South got into his soul and remained there all of his life. Sol and Lizzie Frankel, their two daughters, Madge, 13, Irene, 8, and baby Harry, 3, moved into a gracious and beautiful colonial-pillared house next door to the 44-acre estate of the Milton J. Durhams. The Durhams owned and ran the brick factory. Harry had happy memories always of his old Kentucky home. It colored his thinking. It framed his language and his way of talking. He always insisted that he was born in Kentucky. When his mother would correct him, he would answer, "Mommy, you don't remember. You was asleep when it happened. I remember very well, and I was born in Kentucky." Harry's mother played the piano, his father the violin, and they both sang after a fashion. And every evening after dinner, they would put Harry in the high chair beside the piano while they played and sang the evening away. When most children were just learning to talk, Harry was learning to sing. He would keep time by banging his spoon on his chair. Neither of the girls developed any musical talent. After moving to Kentucky, whenever the family missed young Harry, they could count on finding him in one of two places. The most likely was in the big rambling southern kitchen, a building separate from the house. Long hours he spent there with Uncle Joe, the yard man, and his wife, Aunt Liza, the cook. Next to her own son, Evan, Aunt Liza adored the blonde, blue-eyed boy, bestest in the world. She had an almost fanatical devotion for him. Evan adored him also. 4 or 5 years older than Harry, he appointed himself Harry's bodyguard. The Frankel kitchen was the gathering place for all the colored help in the neighborhood in the late evening, and hour after hour the little boy would listen in fascination to the Negroes singing as only they could sing. It was Aunt Liza who taught him to sing from the heart. He always remembered her words, "Sing from your heart, child, and your soul will follow true." If his sister Madge, who was charged with looking after him, couldn't find him in the kitchen, she would find him down at the creek, Clark's Run, a 22-acre creek area that the gang called their own. Long, lazy afternoons, the gang would go swimming. Milt Durham, Nath Woodcock, Harry Bosley, Fred Grant. And when his work was finished, his faithful Evan and Harry's dog, Shep, a curbstone setter. Swimming days were swell, but rainy days were good, too. For then Milt Durham brought the mules used at the brickyards, and the gang had mule races. Harry's mule usually was the bumpiest. Didn't know which way to go. Shep was no help either, always nipping at the mule's heels. 9 times out of 10, Harry was thrown from his mule into the creek. It would always be his sister, Irene, who would snitch on him. So when she slid off of the ice house roof and broke her arm, He was heard to remark, "Gosh, wish it could have been her tongue she broke." When Harry was 9, his father moved his family and his men's clothing business to Richmond, Indiana, a larger and more quickly progressing town. Accommodations were limited, and so Uncle Joe, Aunt Liza, and Evan had to be left in the employ of another family. For them, and for the small boy, this was a heartbreaking separation. As the train came into Richmond, it passed Glen Miller Park, the town's pride. To the little boy peering out of the train window, it was the biggest park he ever expected to see in his whole life. But not like Clark's Run, and he was overcome with homesickness for Kentucky and all his pals. The future Hoosier-to-be wailed long and loud. After a while, though, he found kindred spirits, boys who liked to swim and fish, but especially fellows who liked to sing, fellows who liked to put on minstrel shows. Gathering on the street corner and having singing fests could sure be fun. Lots more fun than going to school. Harry had an excellent memory and could memorize much more quickly than the average boy, so he did very little studying. Later, when teachers were asked what kind of a student Harry was, the answer was fair, just fair. He never seemed to have his mind inside the school. He always seemed to be looking out of the window at distant places. When singing is in the soul, how can a boy keep his mind on reading, writing, and arithmetic? Harry rarely missed a carnival or circus, and never a minstrel show. Always in the front row, singing with the music. In his teens, he got a quartet together and called it the Belfast Quartet, this title from his store of Pig Latin. He was 16 when he organized the Universal Four, Harry Frankel, Frank Buckingham, Van Hartzler, and Ollie Coughlin. And a traveling salesman heard them singing on a street corner and was amazed at the quality of the voices. Told them they were good enough to be in vaudeville. And when Harry asked how they could go about getting started, he promised to write a friend down in Deep South who owned some little theaters and help get them started. He did. Several weeks later, they left for their first venture into that vast field known as theatrical business. Papa Sol supplied the cash for railroad fares. It was a disappointing affair. In less than a month, they were stranded. And Papa Sol again was the one who had to send the railroad fare, this time for home. They were all a little subdued, but Harry, he had a taste of grease paint. Since no more singing jobs appeared, Harry got a job driving a milk truck. He worked one day, dropped a milk can on his foot and got mad and quit. Went to work for the Star Piano Company in the finishing department. This lasted perhaps a year. In later years, when he built a big house in Richmond with a workshop, the Star Piano Company presented him with the workbench he had used years before. Bill Morey's wife, Eva, an excellent pianist playing at the local theater, persuaded Harry to see Ike Libson in Cincinnati, owner of the Bijou Theater. He was showing something very new. Pictures were flashed onto a screen, and they needed a good voice to sing the songs that went with the pictures. He got the job and remained there some time. Harry and Ike became fast friends. And around 1906, Harry's dream was fulfilled. He was to black up and be in a minstrel show. He joined the J.A. Coburn Minstrel Show, and this was his first meeting with Joe Dunleavy, who later was to be the other half of the team of the Two Blackbirds. Harry had now taken the name of Sam Frankel. And now that Sam had steady work with Coburn's minstrels, he wanted to marry his childhood sweetheart, lovely, fragile, and beautiful Ella Dickey. Every time Harry would take her out for a ride in his Model T, something unpleasant would happen, like the time he picked out a road he didn't know had just been tarred, and he had the blowout. He was all duded out in spotless white flannels and had to get out and change the tire. And the time they got caught in the blinding rainstorm and went into a ditch, and he again was all dressed in white flannels. Well, this car had no horn, and Harry would give a shrill whistle to get pedestrians out of the way. Ella would have married Harry, but her father forbid it. He can't support you, girl. A man can't make a living by putting that black stuff on his face and just standing up singing. Actors are no good loafers, and you'd starve to death. Harry went back on the road, determined to save his money and prove to Ella that he could support her. But 2 years later, when he returned to Richmond, his lovely, dark-eyed Ella was dead. It was his first great grief, and it was many years before he really fell in love again. During his travels, Harry collected pillow tops. His mother would fill them on his return home, and he would enjoy decorating his canoe with them. One afternoon, he put on spotless white flannels and white silk shirt, put all his collection of pillows in his canoe. The whole family watched the tall, handsome, blonde young man as he prepared to paddle out onto lovely Morton Lake. He waved merrily, took a long stroke, hit a sunken log, and capsized into 5 feet of water, the canoe going one way, the pillows another, and Harry standing up to his armpits in the water and mud. Harry was in burlesque with Sally Fields for several seasons as a singer and as a part of quartet, Frankel, Stanhope, Pickett, and Drury. And while in a booking office one day, he was attracted to a young blonde woman who was just leaving the office with her young 5-year-old son. He didn't find out who she was. He should have. For many years later, they were to be married. She was the divorced wife of Ned Wayburn, and the little boy was Ned Jr. After his quartet broke up, Harry went with Al G. Field's Minstrels. This was Harry's favorite entertainment. And even after he retired, it's a fact that he could have been lured into a minstrel show. In New Orleans, in the adjoining theater to the one in which the Al G. was playing, he again saw the girl he had seen in the agent's office. He found out she was known then as Helene Smiles Davis. Both shows were leaving that night, and he didn't get a chance to meet her, but he remembered her for a long time. Those days with Al G. were the highlights of Harry's career. Al G., the dean of minstrelsy, the millionaire minstrel, the crowds down at the railroad to meet the minstrel cars when they arrived, the excitement of unloading, the 11:45 parade with all its color, the men in long tail coats and high hats, the band in its uniforms of bright colors, its flashy banners. The names Neil O'Brien, Lou Dockstetter, Dan Emmett, Press Eldridge, George Primrose, and Frank McNick. Sam was all the things to the show. Could do N-Men, Interlocutor, or a two-man act or quartet. But above all, he could sing in a way that left lasting memories. He sang his way around the country year after year, but always sang the kind of songs everyone loved. The old tunes that were to become his trademark. He was the first of the radio singers to develop an informal way of talking to his audience at a time when formality was at its height. In about 1921, the minstrel show started to decline, and many of the great names of the day started to form small combinations, quartets, two-man teams, or working with a woman partner. Harry Frankel and his friend Bill Murray had opened a camera supply store in Richmond. Joe Dunleavy, from back in the Coburn Minstrel days, had an idea for a blackface act and thought of Harry Frankel, only a few miles from Cincinnati, and went to see him. The boys got busy on dialogue, gags, and songs. They rehearsed at Joe's house in Cincinnati, mostly in the kitchen, stopping now and then to sample Ann Dunleavy, Joe's mother's boiled potatoes and ham. Both boys called her Queen Anne, a beautiful Irish woman. She was their audience, and a good one. She helped them name the act, The Two Blackbirds. Joe, 5'11", slender, nattily dressed, double-breasted blue suit. Sam, 6'1", 195 pounds, narrow, too short trousers, too tight coat, big shoes, bow tie on lopsided, and a small brown derby hat and a uke under his arm. Frankel and Dunleavy, the two blackbirds, became successful enough to warrant a 5-year contract on the Keith Orpheum circuit, which raises in salary each year. They also were assigned to play in the dramatic play, The Spider, during its run in Chicago. They had played about 3 years of their 5-year contract when on one of their trips to Minneapolis, the theater manager requested them to appear on the local radio station as a means of advertisement for the theater. Radio was very much in its infancy, and the boys used only the uke as background for their broadcast. They sang a couple of songs and did a gag or two, and as they walked out of the studio, the manager ran after them and wanted to sign them up right then. That night in the hotel, Joe ridiculed the idea of working on a fool thing like a mic with not even an audience. But Sam was giving it a great deal of thought. By 1929, things were getting pretty tough for vaudeville. The Depression was in full swing, and theaters were closing for want of audiences. The Blackbirds were still working, but not quite as steadily as before. After a week in Columbus, Ohio, the Blackbirds had a week open, and Sam went to Richmond to play a little golf and sit around with his pals. Tom Nichol, vice president of the Great States Lawnmower Company, a go-getter and promoter, felt that this was the time to do heavy advertising. And while playing golf one afternoon with Sam, he asked him what he thought about the radio as a means of advertising. Sam thought it was the greatest medium he could choose. Tom asked Sam if he would do a program for them if they decided to go on the air. With a 12-foot putt to sing, Sam hesitated and then answered, "If I sink this putt, I'll try." "Well, I'll try." He auditioned in Cincinnati, WLW, with no music, just his small guitar. The theme song he chose was "The Green Grass Grew All Around." This was the beginning of a career that carried his voice around the world. Tom paid him $50 a week for 52 weeks. The second year, $100. And the third year, he was to receive $125. He could live home and go to WLW to do his programs. And this suited Sam all right. The team of Franklin WLW broke up after several more weeks. The production manager of WLW wanted Sam to sing popular modern songs, but Sam refused. He said, "I guess I'll just sing the songs that was popular long before you was born, son." And after 4 weeks, the lawnmower program was voted the most popular on WLW. During the off-season for lawnmowers, Tom Nichols subcontracted Sam to the Brand Coffee Company in Cleveland for a 6 month period at $200 a week. Sam got $50, but he could get back home for the weekends. And soon, the barber soul heard him and wanted him. Tom subcontracted Sam to them for $400 a week and gave Sam $200. Sam's attorney wanted him to break his contract with Tom and collect the entire amount for himself, but Sam refused, said he had made a bargain and he would live up to it. Well, at the end of the 3 years, however, he signed with Barbasol. He started at $500 a week, but he had to broadcast from New York, and this was the fly in the ointment for him. While at WLW, his announcer was Gene Paul King, and one of the soloists was Jane Froman, also the Howard brothers, who became the King Jesters of Paul Whiteman fame. In 6 months, Sam sold $90,000 worth of lawnmowers. He was to repeat his phenomenal selling ability for the Barbasol and Coca-Cola programs. Before going on the Barbasol program, he decided that a short, easy-to-remember name would be better. And so became Singin' Sam, the Barbasol Man, over CBS. He sang the theme song, "No Brush, No Lather, No Rub-In," for 7 years. He became one of the most popular entertainers in America, and for a long period was number one on radio, along with Amos and Andy. 1931 saw him well launched on the road to international fame. In September 1931, leaving the NBA Club on 46th Street, en route to the studio, he saw for the third time the same young woman he had seen previously and had wanted to meet. He was so attracted by her outdoor appearance and her deep coat of tan, he made up his mind to meet her. They both smiled in passing. A week later, he asked Smiles pianist Blanche Fincham for an introduction. She was Helene Smiles Davis. The name Smiles carries the story of World War I history. Smiles was blonde, 5'2", brown eyes, 118 pounds. After they met, Sam always seemed to be near whenever Smiles came to the club. Things were getting tough for her. She had just split with her partner and was trying to get back as a single again. But there were no theaters to break in, and she and her pianist were at a standstill. And one day, with nothing to do, she agreed to help Sam sort out fan mail. And while her pianist rehearsed Sam in some songs, she worked on the mail, letters that had not been opened, but had been received 3 months before. From then on, whenever she was not working, she took care of Sam's mail and music. Gradually, she took over his office work and wrote his continuity for him. He finally offered her a job as his secretary, which she held for 2 years when he asked her to marry him. Numerous offers came to him from Hollywood, Scattergood Bane series, A Part in the Great Ziegfeld, and numerous others. He was afraid they might be a success and he would have to move out to Hollywood. He didn't want to make $1 million. He always said, "Don't want that much money. It would just cause us trouble." He bought a home in Richmond after he had worked for the Barbasol Company, and it had been the old swimming hole in the stream several miles out of town. Always said he would buy it if he ever made enough money. He and Smiles married and moved to Richmond. They called their little house just a mere farm, 5 acres on the little river. His wife's pride in her husband ended his long stay with Barbasol. He was losing his identity as just the Barbasol Man. After 7 years, the longest record for one sponsor at that time. 1936 found him with the Coca-Cola Company promoting the new six-bottle carton. His contract was year to year with sliding scale of salary. He grossed $100,000 a year singing four songs a program. These were transcriptions which enabled him to spend most of his time in Richmond, going to New York 3 days at a time every other week. On a hill east of Richmond, Sam and Smiles built on a 49-acre estate a large Southern colonial colored home, a replica of the home Sam remembered from the Danville, Kentucky home he had lived in and loved as a little boy. It also contained many of the features of the Tennessee home of Smiles' father and grandparents. They called it Trooper Hill. Sam built a modern workshop for his hobby and a sewing room for Smiles. The huge Rumpus room was named by one of their gang as the Hoosit Room. The walls were covered with hundreds of framed photos of friends of the theater, many autographed, but some not. Thus the name, Sam Hoosit. Some have since passed on, but many remain. Fred and Adele Astaire, Bing Crosby, Jack Benny, Major Bose, Marvin Miller, Amos and Andy, Georgie Jessel, Eddie Cantor, and many others. Sam would spend hours loafing in Kessler's sport goods store, swapping tales of fishing and hunting. Sometimes, when they were rushed, he would wait on a customer. If he happened to be a stranger, he would have been surprised if he had known that the slow-speaking, deep-voiced clerk with the sandy, receding hairline was the famous Singin' Sam. He disliked nightclubs and public places, was embarrassed at recognition, and when confronted with the claim, would say in an embarrassed way, "Gosh, Mommy, I'm just a singer, and there's lots better than me." His alliance with the Coca-Cola company was brought to a stop when Petrillo called off all recordings. Coca-Cola wanted him to do live shows 5 nights a week out of New York. This he refused, so by mutual consent, the contracts were severed. They then wanted to reuse his old recordings, but Sam's manager put too high a price on them. In loyalty to his manager, he did not go over his head, but it made him a very unhappy man, for he felt they had been the finest people he had ever worked for and was willing for them to use the recordings and would have accepted the offer they made to him. This was the cause of a break in the relationship between manager and artist and friend, and so Sam sought another manager. 1945, Sam sent Mommy to build a small house in Florida. He wanted to retire after making a series of transcriptions that he felt could be used on radio stations indefinitely. He formed the Transcription Sales Company with headquarters in Springfield, Ohio. These are the transcriptions that are being heard over the country today. 1946, he retired, sold Trooper Hill, and moved to Florida to spend 8 months of the year. They chose Sarasota as the place they liked best. Sarasota liked them equally as well as they liked the town. He fished, played golf, and lazied around in the sun. In June 1948, they went back to Richmond, intending to sell all their holdings and to settle in Sarasota permanently. 2 weeks later, he was gone. For 3 years after his going, his program could still be heard over the local station. Badger's Drugstore continued its contract, and this was a solace to all who listened. He still sings. Children still want to hear him at bedtime, and he is still remembered with heartwarming gratitude.
Refreshment Time with Singin' Sam, the transcribed feature presented daily, Mondays through Fridays, by the Coca-Cola Bottling Company.
Howdy, folks. This is old Singin' Sam preparing to sing out with some numbers that I've selected for today's program of Refreshment Time. And the first one up will be I'm Looking Over a Four-Leaf Clover. I'm looking over a four-leaf clover that I overlooked before. One leaf is sunshine, the second is rain. Third is the roses that grow in the lane. No need explaining, the one remaining is somebody I adore. I'm looking over a four-leaf clover that I overlooked before. somebody I adore. I'm looking over a four-leaf clover I overlooked before.
You know, singing is really one of my sidelines because my specialty is refreshment. Spell with a capital R, brought to you at home by means of Coca-Cola in the handy six-bottle carton, and served ice cold from your family refrigerator. Are you getting this service at your house? Well, to get back on the sidelines, our next song is Starlight, Starbright. Just a simple, pretty tune. And then for some reason, it stays popular forever. Here's a song that's that way, Mary Ann.
I wake up thinking of you, Mary Ann. You're on my mind a livelong day. I must confess I love you, Mary Ann. I guess I give myself away. Every star up in the sky seems to wink as we go by. Mary Ann, Mary Ann, all the daisies in the dell seem to know but they won't tell. Mary Ann, Mary Ann, every little rosebud blooming in the heather seem to whisper, go on, get together. I can't wait until the time when we'll hear the church bells chime. I'll be yours and you'll be mine, Mary Ann.
Silver star up in the sky, so wink as we go by, Mary Ann, Mary Ann.
Thank you. up in the sky seems to wink as we go by. Mary Ann, Mary Ann, all the daisies in the dell seem to know, but they won't tell. Mary Ann, Mary Ann, every little woman moving in the dell seems to whisper, go on, yes, again. I can't wait.